continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. The Court of Appeals concluded, and respondent agrees, that the Due Process Clause requires either that the district judge defer to the magistrate's proposed findings of fact or to rehear the testimony. But this analysis doesn't make any sense in the facts of this case. Here, the district court adopted the magistrate's findings. If the district court had merely deferred to the magistrate's findings, it would have again denied the motion. That it made a more thorough review and did not defer could not possibly have deprived respondent of any kind of procedural protections. In fact, he received more protection because he got a more thorough review. We also believe that the Court of Appeals analysis is flawed in failing to consider the three facts that this Court has set forth that should be considered in determining what process is due in a particular circumstance. That is, the personal interest involved, the risk of erroneous deprivation of that interest, and the government's administrative and financial interests in adhering to the procedure set forth.
Counsel, supposing the magistrate had decided the other way, and on review, that is, had held that the statement should be suppressed, and on review at the instance of the government, without looking, taking any additional evidence, the court had overruled that determination. Would you say it was still just there would be no purpose to the to having it? I mean, then would you say the standard didn't make any difference, is it?
No, the standard would certainly be different because he would be able to review, overturn him, that is, the district court would be able to overturn the magistrate even though the findings of fact were not, quote, clearly erroneous. He would be able to
And he could do it without taking any additional evidence.
That's right. Now,
but see, you say the defendant really doesn't get hurt by the Court of Appeals position, but he might be hurt if it had gone the other way before the magistrate, is what I'm saying.
But I think in this criminal case, the respondent can't raise the deprivation that might occur to others here. In this case, he had a full and fair hearing before the magistrate. The magistrate may propose findings of fact against him. Those findings have ample support in the record, and the district court, upon making a thorough review of that record, the magistrate's report, and the submission of the parties, concluded that the motion should be denied. The case would be a more difficult one, perhaps, where it was purely a swearing contest between a defendant and a...
But your view of the procedure, now you're saying he doesn't have standing to make this argument, I have to think that through, but your view of the procedure is that even if it's a swearing contest between the officer and the defendant, the district judge may nevertheless, in its so-called de novo review, reverse the finding of the magistrate without hearing any additional evidence.
Well, that's a much more difficult question. When it's purely a swearing contest and the evidence is equally balanced.
Well, but as a matter of statutory construction, you say that that's
yes.
What Congress intended.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Haven't we hinted, if we have not held, that credibility findings are rarely, if ever, to be reviewed on a cold record?
You have
where to reverse them on the hypothetical that Justice Stevens has just posed. Is it not one thing to affirm credibility findings on a cold record and quite another to reverse them on a cold record?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chief Justice, and that is why we say in our brief that the district court could reverse the magistrate's proposed findings. In a case like this one, for example, where there are objective factors in the record to support the magistrate's what the magistrate actually concluded, but let's assume that the magistrate concluded that he believed respondent. Well, there are various objective factors in this record which make respondent's testimony fairly incredible at points. From which, on reading on the Cole record, you can tell that the respondent he admitted that he lied on November 19th. His August 8th, he claims he made no statement on August 8th. Yet that statement. That is attributed to him by the Chicago police and appears in the arrest report is the same statement that he admits having made on January 12th. And it's just inherently incredible that the Chicago police made up a statement which respondent admits that he subsequently made in January following his arrest. So in this kind of a case where there are objective factors aside from the just a pure swearing contest, the district court in making its de novo determination could reverse the magistrate. Obviously, the district court is on shaky ground in those circumstances where it's purely a swearing contest and he simply reverses the magistrate. And that
so
is a much
he
more...
He believes what the trier of facts disbelieved. Is that the kind of a case you're posing?
Well, that would be difficult to do. But here we don't have that problem, of course, because he adopted the magistrate's findings.
It's not difficult under the statute. I mean,
that's correct.
The statute makes no distinction.
That's correct. But due process may come into play at some point where it's purely a swearing contest, and the district court reverses the magistrate. Of course, as I said before, that did not happen here. The magistrate evaluated the respondent's testimony, found it not to be credible, and the district court adopted those findings.
Let me touch that out with this hypothetical. Suppose the magistrate made careful and detailed findings that he believed the defendant and disbelieved the officers, and therefore recommended the suppression of the testimony. Now, the district judge, reading the record and nothing more, reverses the district judge on the credibility finding. You mean that would give rise to due process questions?
Yes, although that would be similar to what happens in agency proceedings. The same kind of relationship that exists between the magistrate and the district court exists in agent proceedings, in the British special master situation, in special masters and original cases in this court. And normally the reviewing court, or the court that has the power to enter the judgment, does not simply toss aside the magistrate's findings. And it has to, and normally would give them credit for what they're worth based on his independent review of the record. And when a reviewing court reviews, let's say, the SEC's determination of something, it may be that the ALJ concluded adversely to the agency's finding of fact. And that is something under Universal Camera Corp, this court's decision in Universal Camera Corp, that the reviewing court can take into account as to whether there's substantial evidence in the record or whether the district court's determination is erroneous.
Don't you take into account a difference between findings of fact generally and findings of fact based entirely on credibility of the speaker?
That's absolutely correct. And where, of course, the only issue is credibility, the district court, if you wanted to reverse the magistrate, and the only issue was credibility, and evidence was equipoised between the respondent and the defendant, the defendant and the police officer, then the district court could not simply ignore the magistrate's determination of credibility. If he wished to reverse the magistrate in that circumstance, he would probably have to rehear the testimony or recommit it back to the magistrate for further findings.
What would you say he'd probably have to do that? What would require him to do it?
Due process.
You think the Constitution would require him to do that?
Well, because in the case in which there was solely credibility at issue.
Isn't that about what Judge Sprecher said this case was? That you have a credibility determination, and therefore due process requires the judge to hear the evidence himself. It's just that they're affirming instead of reversing.
Well, but that's a big difference, because here an impartial, neutral Article III adjunct has evaluated the credibility and made specific findings about that credibility, and the district court has credited those findings based on his independent review of the record. And so therefore, just like an agent.
What if he says on the review, well, I really can't tell because you've got a swearing contest here. But even though the statute directs me to give a de novo hearing, there's really no way to do it, but I'll just assume they're probably right. Could he have done that?
Yes. And then he would be giving the magistrate's report that credibility which it is due. He would say that I trust the magistrate. The magistrate has made a finding having viewed credibility. The magistrate is equally competent as a district judge to evaluate a simple matter of credibility. I mean, juries are entrusted in our system to evaluate credibility, and it doesn't take a
district. What do the words de novo determination mean, then?
A much more thorough review than a simple clearly erroneous standard.
Well, doesn't de novo ordinarily mean you're privileged to submit additional evidence to the reviewer?
That is when it says de novo hearing or a de novo review. This is a de novo determination of the magistrate's report. That's what the statute says. And legislative history makes quite clear that Congress did not intend the district court to rehear testimony on contested issues. That statement appears over and over again in the legislative history.
Well, then why did they use the word de novo?
To contrast it to subsection A, in which the magistrate hears and determines motions, and the district court must give deference on a clearly erroneous standard to the magistrate's findings. The Court of Appeals, in our view, simply misevaluated the three factors underlying the due process analysis. In Lego against Toomey, this court made clear that a suppression hearing does not implicate the important issue of guilt or innocence. It is simply a matter of the conduct of the police that is in question, and the question is whether or not evidence which is wholly probative and relevant shall be kept out because of the conduct of the police. Second, the Court of Appeals viewed this to be a very have a high risk of erroneous deprivation, yet the same kind of proceeding has been used in England for many years. It is used in all the administrative agencies, and it is used by this court in its original jurisdiction cases. And finally, the Court of Appeals did not at all address the government's substantial interests in using magistrates. There's a terrible problem of congested litigation, and magistrates, in a recent article in appearing in 16 Harvard Journal of Legislation, it's been shown that a study shows that the use of magistrates has increased by a third the ability of district courts to dispose of cases. And in 1979, over 3,000 evidentiary hearings were conducted by magistrates under Section 636B1B, a considerable saving of time. And these things were not addressed by the Court of Appeals at all. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I might.
Ms. Gottschall.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. As the government stated this morning, the Magistrates Act not only withholds from the magistrate decision-making power with respect to case dispositive motions, but it expressly provides that if any party objects to any finding or any recommendation of the magistrate, quote, a judge of the court shall make a de novo determination of those portions of the report or specified proposed findings to which objection is made.
Laying aside for a moment, what differences, if any, there may be between a de novo determination and a de novo hearing, do you think there is a difference between a district judge affirming a magistrate's finding on credibility and reversing a finding on credibility?
I do not. I think that the question is whether the district judge is in a position to make an independent determination. If all the district judge does is looks at what the magistrate has done and says, well, this is a credibility finding, I obviously don't have the evidence before me to reevaluate that, I don't see how that can possibly be explained as any kind of a de novo determination of anything. And I think that's the difference between what the Court of Appeals felt and the position that the government is urging now.
What do you think is the difference between a de novo determination and a de novo hearing?
I don't believe there is any difference, and I think that the prior decisions of this Court established that very clearly. First of all, let me just point out that this Act does not use the word hearing the way the government suggests, that is, an evidentiary hearing. This Act speaks of hearing motions for summary judgment and motions to dismiss complaints and all kinds of things that are not evidentiary. And this Court, in the case of United States versus First City National Bank, had virtually an identical argument before it, where a party claimed that because a statute spoke of de novo review rather than trial de novo, that there was to be more limited judicial review. And the Court rejected that. It said that the critical concept is de novo, and what de novo means is that there has to be an independent determination of the issues. And I would just suggest that in many decisions of this Court, virtually all the decisions of this Court that talk about de novo, all of these terms are used interchangeably. I think this is quite clearly a distinction without a difference.
Do you have to have a whole new hearing?
I don't believe so, Mr. Justice Marshall. I think that what it appears that the Act contemplated was that the district judge would be able to evaluate on what issues it would be necessary for him to rehear evidence in order to make a de novo determination. Now, the case has established that one of those issues
is
credibility.
Wouldn't it end up in a new hearing?
As to credibility questions,
well,
yes.
What good is sending out the magistrate if you're going to have two hearings?
Well, there are a lot of ways the statute...
Do you think Congress meant to establish another hearing? An extra hearing?
What I believe that Congress was trying to do was to take some of these motions away from district judges to the extent possible while preserving the district judge's ability to make a decision of those issues. And I think that the suggestion that the statute is rendered useless because in cases where credibility was critical or some other source of evidence that wasn't included in the record required a rehearing, I don't think that's true. I would expect that there are a great many matters where if there's an initial hearing before a magistrate, there can be a stipulated record developed, a question of law can surface, and many different things can happen that will avoid the necessity of having to rehear the evidence. I think I would suggest that a real swearing contest, such as occurred in this case, is really rather unusual. Perhaps not in confession cases. The court has noted that confession cases typically involve this kind of thing. But in all the great variety of matters that are covered by Section 636B1B, I would expect that credibility would not be a critical issue in that many cases.
In suppression of tangible evidence cases, you say it would not be?
I don't think it would be uniformly.
Not uniformly, but overwhelmingly. Overwhelmingly.
It would. That
they
would.
They are contests of credibility. I say that on the basis of having reviewed almost literally thousands of records in the courts of appeals when the Court of Appeals had general jurisdiction over the District of Columbia.
Well, I think it may be a different.
I'm not sure it makes a difference, but I think your statement of the fact is not based on is not consistent with. My observation.
There's a different kind of credibility question, I would think, in Fourth Amendment cases, in the generality of cases. In general, there would be one, probably police officers testifying as to perhaps articulable facts that they observed that they contended amounted to probable cause.
The evidence was in plain sight, and the defendant says, no, it was not in plain sight, it was in his back pocket, and that sort of thing. Isn't that typical of the type of evidence you have?
Well, I don't know exactly how many or what percentage of Fourth Amendment suppression motions would raise this kind of credibility question. It may be suppression motions do raise credibility questions in the majority of cases.
You might well argue that if, in fact, they're overwhelmingly credibility contests, that is the reason for an Article III judge to hear them.
I would think that's right, because in that situation, the independence of the decision maker is critically important. And I would point out that I think the legislative history is very clear that credibility findings and findings of fact in which credibility figured were very clearly covered by the de novo review provision. There is really no question on the basis of this legislative history that Congress contemplated that credibility issues would be redetermined just like any other issues, that any finding of fact of the magistrate would be subject to this de novo review provision.
Well, I would have reached almost the opposite conclusion from hearing the government's argument that the statutory language probably is in your favor, but that the legislative history is against you.
I think there are two questions, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. The first question is the standard of review when a finding is objected to. And I don't believe that there's any conflict between the parties in this case that the judge is supposed to make an independent determination of the issue. The government states in its brief that the judge would be violating the statute if he deferred to the magistrate on fact findings. So I think on that point there's agreement. The problem arises on the question of what procedures the judge has to follow in evaluating the magistrate's recommendations. And what the legislative history says, it is true that the statement that the government has quoted consistently in its brief, the use of the words de novo determination is not intended to require the judge to actually conduct a new hearing on contested issues, that's true. But the government consistently omits the two explanatory sentences which follow, which state that normally the judge on application will consider the record which has been developed before the magistrate and make his own determination on the basis of that record. But in some specific instances, however, it may be necessary for the judge to modify or reject the findings of the magistrate, to take additional evidence, to recall witnesses, or to recommit the matter to the magistrate for further proceedings. There's no question that Congress contemplated that rehearing would be necessary in some cases. And from the cases that Congress cited...
The government doesn't contend otherwise, does it? Does it?
Well, the government seems to...
I asked specifically if that was one of the options that was open to the judge. The government said yes, occasionally he would have a hearing himself.
The government suggests, though, a completely unreviewable standard of discretion, that whether the judge decides to hear evidence or decides not to hear evidence is completely unreviewable, that it depends on how the judge feels on that particular day. That can't possibly be the law.
He also conceded that... if a district judge, reversed a credibility finding, it might. I don't think he conceded it would, but it might well give rise to serious due process questions.
I think the question is whether the judge has to put himself in a position where he can fulfill the statutory requirement that he make a de novo determination. The government's argument is basically saying that all the process that an objecting party is entitled to is to have the magistrate affirmed. That if you objected to the magistrate's findings, and if the judge affirmed the magistrate, there'd be no problem. But if you objected to the magistrate's findings and the district judge reversed the magistrate, well, then there'd be due process constraints on that.
What's your position with respect to, say, the magistrate granting a motion for summary judgment? You don't have those in criminal case, but suppose in a civil case, and it comes before the district court. Do you say that the judges ought to, there are affidavits on both sides, who call it a swearing contest? Do you say the district judge must, as a matter of law under this act, hear the witnesses or at least read the affidavits himself?
Absolutely not. I think that case is covered by this court's decision in Matthews versus Weber, where the parties can focus the judge's attention on the problems that they have with the magistrate's recommendation. And the judge can go to the record, and he has the evidence before him that was before the magistrate, and with the guidance of the parties, he can make an independent determination of whether or not the magistrate was correct. I don't think there's any problem.
But here, supposing the district court has denied a motion for summary judgment, saying there's a credibility issue here, I can't tell which of the parties is telling the truth. Do you think the district court could reverse that and say, I've determined that one of the parties is telling the truth and the other isn't?
On a motion for summary judgment?
Yes.
On affidavits? No, I don't think the law would permit that at all. I think that's...
That isn't permitted the magistrate or anybody.
That's correct. Now, that's contrary to the whole notion of motions for summary judgment, which are responsive to the same concerns that the Court of Appeals was worried about here, making credibility determinations on the basis of cold records.
The government doesn't argue that whatever judgment the district judge makes of the magistrate's findings isn't subject to review, does it?
It appears to me that what the government is suggesting is something like a substantial evidence standard, which this Court has always said is equivalent to record review. If, regardless of the nature of the issues, all the judge does is look at the record, then really what the judge is doing is simply making sure that there's evidence in the record to support the magistrate's conclusion.
Well, what if the judge says, I've read the record, I've read the written record, I've read the record of the evidence, and I make my own determination as follows? And it just so happens that every determination agrees with the magistrate. That wouldn't satisfy you.
It would depend on whether the district judge.
Oh, I know, but let's assume there are square conflicts in the evidence.
Yes.
Or in the testimony before
yes.
the master. So that process wouldn't satisfy you. The judge must call witnesses.
If there's a testimonial conflict and mm-hmm. credibility is, if there were some.
Well, I didn't. I thought the government was saying that the government doesn't urge that the court is free not to make its own determination, does it?
The government's position seems to be that the court has to make its own determination.
Yes, it reads the evidence, it reads the record, and makes its determinations. If there's a conflict, it resolves them itself. And if it disagrees with the magistrate, it disagrees. And if it agrees, it agrees with the magistrate. And it could, if it wanted to, have a hearing.
I think that whether what the judge does, whether it is permissible under established principles of due process and fair procedure, depends on whether the judge has an adequate basis before him for making that decision. And that depends on the importance of issues such as credibility and basically on the state of the record and what kind of issues it is that he's evaluating.
Well, then he can send it to a magistrate.
If the judge believes that it will assist him in the disposition of cases, can send anything under Section 636 to a magistrate.
But if there's any conflict, he has to try it all over again.
With respect to any findings to which objections are made, and to the extent the credibility or some other issue like that is present.
The only thing to prevent a defendant from getting two hearings is not to object.
On a matter of credibility, I would agree with that, but I would point out
Do you have many hearings that credibility isn't involved?
I frankly don't know what how this comes out in the generality of cases.
You don't need a hearing. If there's not going to be disagreements, you don't need a hearing.
Mr. Justice Marshall, I don't think that's correct for this reason. In a criminal case, largely because of the discovery rules and a lot of other factors, the fact is that the parties do not know what the testimony is going to be at the suppression hearing before they hear it. And in many suppression hearings that I've been involved in...
Well, how come you did object?
Yes.
Why did you object? You didn't know, but you objected? Must have known something because you objected.
To the admission of the evidence?
No, you objected to the being referred to the magistrate.
Well, I expected that credibility would be an issue in this case, and I told that to the district judge.
You knew about credibility. So why wouldn't it be better just don't have the magistrate?
In this case, I think it clearly would have been better.
So that's really what you're against, the magistrates, aren't you?
Well...
But Congress has overruled you.
I don't think that's right. I think that Congress has made a policy decision in the area of case dispositive motions.
Well, who else can make that decision other than Congress? Who else can make a decision as to the judicial process in this country other than Congress?
Well, I think the Constitution may put some restraints on that. When you're talking about case dispositive motions in an Article III court and an issue arising directly under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, I don't think the issue has to be reached in this case because of the de novo determination requirement. But the fact of the matter is that there may be constraints on the power of Congress.
So if Congress had expressly said that magistrates will... make findings of fact and resolve issues of turning on credibility, and that the district judge shall accept them if they're supported by substantial evidence. Would you say that there's a constitutional issue?
I guess you would.
But nobody is being sent to jail as a result of the magistrate's denial of this suppression here, of this suppression motion. It required the stipulation of the parties to forego a trial in order to have the magistrate's hearing become what was in effect the trial record, did it not? Had you been dissatisfied with the magistrate's ruling on the suppression motion and the district court's affirmance of it, you could have gone ahead and had a full-scale trial.
I'm not entirely certain that all of the issues in this case at the suppression motion could have been tried before a jury. And certainly the decision of a jury would not be the decision that the law on the Fifth Amendment itself, in fact, requires the judge to make in this case. It would have been a different decision with different factors being important.
But what would have happened if you had not stipulated and the time came during the trial, the confession is offered in evidence? You certainly would have objected, would you not?
Well, under the rules, my understanding is that once that the pretrial motion has been decided adversely, there's no need to make an objection, and that's the end of it. It's the law of the case.
But you can't object.
One might be able to. You might be permitted to do it, but you certainly don't have to do it. And if you were permitted to do it, you'd be doing something somewhat different from what you're doing in a pretrial hearing.
The issue of, was it a voluntariness question?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Well, you certainly are entitled to have that submitted to the jury.
On the issue of reliability.
How about voluntariness?
I've seen cases going both ways on that question in terms of the legal standard.
Well, have you seen one where it's denied? If you ask, if you request to put on evidence about the voluntariness issue before the jury and have the judge instruct on it in the federal system?
I'm not sure. I can't really think of any case. It wasn't my understanding that I would be allowed to relitigate the constitutional question, apart from questions of reliability, the precise issue that the law required me to make as a pretrial motion again.
What authority do you have on that?
I may not be correct on that. That has been my understanding.
I thought Jackson against Deno just said the judge had to make an initial determination and that many jurisdictions, including the federal, permitted the question of voluntariness to be submitted to the jury also.
Well, as I say, I'm not sure what the law is. At least in some form, I suspect I could have submitted that question to the jury. But that certainly would not serve the interests that the government is putting forth in this case. If in order to have an Article III judge hear the evidence relevant to the Fifth Amendment issue, I have to take a jury trial. It seems to me that that is probably as counterproductive of...
Well, that isn't congressional. That's the fault of Jackson against Deno.
Or at any rate, it may not serve the interest of the government, but would uphold the constitutionality of the statute.
I don't think that submitting the issue of voluntariness to the trial jury would be a satisfactory determination of the question of voluntariness under this court's decisions.
The Wells Jackson against Dennis says maybe you have to submit it to the trial judge too.
My understanding of Jackson versus Deno is that it entitles the defendant to a hearing outside the presence of the trial jury on the issue of voluntariness. So I don't think that submitting that issue to the trial jury would be of consequence in terms of whether this is an adequate determination of the voluntariness question itself.
The judge may then submit it, allow it to go to the jury if he makes the appropriate findings under Jackson v. Deno, may he not?
Yes, Your Honor, he may. Once he's decided that it's admissible, then he's permitted to let it go to the jury.
But in some jurisdictions, and I think the federal, if the defendant wants, he can have the issue of voluntariness resubmitted to the jury.
Yes, I believe that's right. I'm still not entirely convinced that all of the evidence that might be relevant to the voluntariness inquiry on the pretrial hearing would be properly submitted to the jury. But certainly in some jurisdictions, I understand that to be true.
Counsel, you've been asked questions about civil cases. It's not clear to me whether you draw a distinction at all between civil and criminal cases.
I think that whether there is a distinction between civil and motions related to criminal cases like suppression motions would depend on whether one were to analyze this problem as a matter of the construction of the statute and the de novo determination requirement.
Let's think in terms of due process.
Perhaps not under the Seventh Circuit's opinion.
Right.
But it seems to me that the rules, the importance of demeanor evidence in making credibility determinations is so much a part of all judicial process, whether it be criminal or civil, that while the interests at stake might not be as critical in, say, the preliminary injunction context, that principle about demeanor evidence would probably make this holding extend to that context. It would be a slightly different analysis.
You rely on Chief Justice Hughes' language in the first Morgan case, which, of course, was a civil case, wasn't it?
I'm not entirely sure. I don't remember right off. It must have been, but I... Well, my
don't count on me for being infallible.
Counsel, is your submission as to criminal cases limited to situations where there is what we've been calling a swearing contest?
I think that is the clearest case.
Yes.
I think that in, for instance, the Fourth Amendment context, which Mr. Chief Justice Berger mentioned, the analysis might be different. For instance, in the summary judgment context, in considering, for instance, summary judgment in a case that was going to be tried to the bench rather than to a jury, so there weren't jury trial issues, the judge would have somewhat more latitude in resolving factual questions on the basis of affidavits than he would in some other contexts. So whether, for instance, if at the hearing before the magistrate, the evidence, there was no conflicting testimony, but there was a question of credibility, perhaps then a determination of which party had the burden might be relevant. I think that gets into a much more complicated situation. But certainly where there's a swearing contest, the trial judge had no reasonable basis for making a de novo decision of the factual matters. And that was the basis for the Seventh Circuit's opinion. The Seventh Circuit read the record, and their conclusion was that it was simply impossible to determine the truth from that written record. The evidence was simply too conflicting and too inconsistent.
Ms. Gottschall, how are magistrates appointed? What is their tenure and how long is their term?
Mr. Justice Stewart, they are appointed by the judges of the district court, by a majority of the judges of the district court. The offices, I believe, are established by the judicial conference, and their terms are 8-year terms.
Are they removable at will during the...
They're removable for a range of reasons, including incompetency, neglect of duty. Yes, that's right.
Not at will.
That's correct. There has to be some kind of a hearing, I think, before they're removed.
8-year terms.
Yes.
What would you say to a state proceeding which originally went before a JP tried by him, and the state statute provided for a de novo review by the Superior Court or the Circuit Court or whatever the Court of General Jurisdiction was?
My understanding of those statutes is that the defendant is entitled to have the trial again in the higher level court. That it isn't a record review, but it's a relitigation of the issues.
And you say here you feel you are not entitled to have the trial again.
There's de novo language in old statutes and old cases that indicates that what de novo means is you begin from scratch and do it all again as if nothing had ever happened. The more recent federal authorities seem to be working on some standards for de novo which give more play to the possibility of eliminating some issues than those old cases did. We could have argued that the judge was required to redo it. It seemed that in view of the purposes of the legislation and the statements in the congressional history, that the proper approach was the approach taken by some of these recent federal decisions, which indicates that de novo requires reconsideration of live evidence only to the extent that issues like credibility, motivation, veracity, and those kind of issues are present. Apart from that, the district judge has a great deal of discretion to try to work out stipulations, to admit the prior record, and engage in a number of duplication-saving devices as long as he puts himself in a position to make a truly independent decision on the credibility questions. I'd like to speak for a minute because I think that the government's position comes down largely to the question of the costs of rehearing and the costs in terms of economic and administrative considerations of not sending motions to suppress to magistrates, and number two, requiring the judge to hear selected evidence rather than reading a transcript. And we have included in our brief some recent statistics that indicate that the whole issue of suppression motions, the hearing of suppression motions, are not in any event a very substantial part of the workload of district judges or magistrates. But beyond that, it seems to me that the best answer to that argument is the docket sheet in this case. The government says that the interest of judicial efficiency has been saved by this procedure where all there was a reading of the record. But I'd like to suggest that this motion to suppress would in all likelihood have been heard by a district judge in a day and ruled on from the bench. What in fact happened was that it took 5 months. And the reason it took 5 months was because first the magistrate had to hold a hearing, and then a transcript had to be prepared, which is not that common in most motions to suppress that I've been involved in if there's not going to be an appeal. The parties, the lawyers, both of whom were government lawyers, had to prepare proposed fact findings and recommendations. The magistrate had to review all this material and write a report to the district judge with proposed fact findings. The parties had to file objections to the magistrate's report. The district judge had to read all this record, which by this time included a voluminous transcript. Presumably, in many cases, he would hear oral argument. And then he had to go about the process of trying to decide from the transcript, with all this conflicting testimony, what in fact happened. Now, if any time were to be saved by having the district judge rehear selected testimony rather than reading this transcript, I would submit that it would be a very minimal savings at best. And we have included in our brief some references to some recent congressional hearings in which district judges have begged Congress not to give them appellate-type duties with respect to magistrates' civil trial jurisdiction because they find that it's quicker for them to hear the issues again rather than reading through a transcript.
But the judge didn't have to send this to the magistrate. If he wanted to save time, he could have tried it, couldn't he?
Well,
couldn't he?
If he thought it would save him time, he could have, yes.
Well, couldn't he? Well,
yes.
What is your argument?
As to why he sent it to the magistrate?
No, I mean, he could have taken it himself and saved, 5 months?
I don't know.
Well, you said this case. In this case, if the judge had tried the motion to suppress without the magistrate, he would have saved a whole lot of time, you say.
I think in reality that's true.
Well, so what? He didn't. That was up to him.
That's right, but I think that the government has made
it. That wasn't an error, was it, to send it to the magistrate?
He had the power to send it to the magistrate. There's no question about it.
And he had the power not to send it.
I think when it comes down to the question of whether rehearing selected testimony is going to frustrate the purposes of this legislation, it's got to be considered in reference to the alternative. And what the alternative is, the government's position is that the alternative is reading a transcript. The Ninth Circuit's alternative is that a tape recording has to be prepared. As I understand it, the Sixth Circuit still holds to its old Wedding versus Wingo. The rules still represent the condition they were in at the time of Wingo versus Wedding, that a tape recording has to be prepared.
Well, you mean the Ninth Circuit requires the district judge to listen to the tape recording or that one be prepared?
The most recent discussion of that was in the O'Rahn case, which the government has cited in its brief. And it was, I think, a habeas corpus situation, and the Ninth Circuit reversed the district court, stating that in that case he hadn't even had a transcript. The Ninth Circuit noted that he also hadn't had a tape recording, which was still the prevailing law of the circuit, and that it was remanded for him to reconsider whether he ought to have a tape recording. They cited Campbell. They cited this case. And so I don't think the requirements are really fixed yet. But it is obvious under this statute that something has to be written in so that the judge has some basis for making his decision. Thank you.
Mrs. Batchel, I might add that after looking at the cases, I'm just not sure what the rule is in the Seventh Circuit on resubmission of voluntariness to the jury. I may have overspoken.
Thank you.
You have something further, Mr. Levander?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. First, 18 U.S.C. 3501 requires in a federal case if the defendant wants it, that the jury consider voluntariness separate and apart from the pretrial submission.
That's after the judges.
That is absolutely correct, Mr. Justice.
When was that statute passed?
That was passed in 1968 part of the Unwitness Crime Control Act. Yes.
So it codified. It codified the Massachusetts procedure.
That's correct.
Yes. I didn't overstate myself.
The de novo language in this case and this statute is much different than the de novo language that Mr. Justice Rehnquist was thinking about and the cases that respondent relies on. This is not a de novo hearing; it is a de novo determination. And in the act itself, Congress uses the word hear and determine and hear when it wants the district court to do so and when it enabled the magistrate to do so. And so, therefore, in contrasting that language, it seems quite clear that even the language of the act, much less the legislative history, does support the government's position. Second, respondents' position as to the due process point would render suspect numerous kinds of proceedings in which the original initial trier of fact, or the person who evaluates credibility, is not the person who makes the determination of fact. That is an agency proceedings.
Mr. Levander, none of those cases are cases in which the court is directed to make a de novo determination.
I understand
Judge Brecker's argument to be that when a de novo determination must be made and credibility is an issue, that then due process requires that the witnesses be heard.
Well, in Milner against Galata, the case involved disbarment proceedings in the state of New York, precisely like this sort of situation. There was a referee who conducted the official kind of proceeding, evaluated the witnesses' credibility, the lawyer's testimony against the complaining witnesses. And his decision was not determinative. He had no power to determine. Thereafter, the appellate division, a court reviewing the record, made the de novo determination. And the language is in the case. Three-judge court upheld that statute. This court summarily affirmed. And it seems to me that case is fairly dispositive of the due process point that's argued here by respondent. And in that case, there was some suggestion that the appellate courts were reversing the referee's findings. Here, of course, the district court has affirmed and adopted the magistrate's finding, the person who has evaluated the credibility.
Well, on that point of affirming versus reversing, do I correctly understand you to suggest that in making the de novo determination, the judge may give some deference to the views of the magistrate?
He is to credit it for what it's worth.
Well, that means he may give some deference to it. So it's not really 100% de novo. It's like 99.5%.
No, he first makes a de novo determination, a thorough review. And having made the thorough review...
Well, his thorough review is that the evidence is in conflict. It depends on whether I believe A or B. I really don't know without seeing them. So the only thing I can go on is that the magistrate believed A. Can he affirm on that basis?
He can.
So he can give some deference to the determination.
That's correct.
So then it's not 100% de novo.
Well, but the, preceding his determination to credit the magistrate,
he found it must to be 50-50.
Must be a de novo determination. And the I see my time is up, but I could finish this one answer.
I'd like you to.
Where he is reversing, where there was a pure swearing contest and is reversing, it may be an abuse of discretion under the statute for him to simply ignore the credibility findings of the magistrate. Again, he gives it some value. He must give it some value. And if it's purely a swearing contest, he's abused his discretion in either not affirming the magistrate's evaluation or in rehearing the testimony.
In either event, the words de novo mean he must give some deference to the magistrate, under your view, if I understand you.
Only he gives it whatever there's worth, and he need not give it any deference, but he can. He can always choose to rehear the
well,
motion.
Well, if he can, the language of the statute is mandatory. It says he shall make a de novo determination.
That's right.
Then, which would mean to me that he has to do it. And if you're saying that he may give deference to the magistrate, it's not a 100% de novo.
He doesn't give deference to the magistrate insofar.
Well, he just say he can affirm, but he can't reverse if the evidence is evenly balanced. That's what you told me.
That's right. But then he's
well, the only difference between the cases of affirming and reversing is that in one case he gives deference to the magistrate, and the other
he
doesn't.
He credits it for what it's worth.
It's worth something. That's what it's worth. But your position is that it's worth something.
If he wishes to make it so. Otherwise, he may rehear the testimony. If he doesn't think that the magistrate's determination, he doesn't trust it, he thinks the evidence is truly equipoised. That is not the case in this case. And again, the district court affirmed the magistrate's finding.
Isn't your position at odds with the dictionary meaning of de novo?
Well, whatever the dictionary meaning is, it's quite clear here what Congress had in mind.
The common understanding of what that phrase means. I don't know what the dictionary says either.
Well, anew, I think it means. And
anew. Anew.
Well, he gives it a fresh look, and that's what Congress had in mind.
On a clean slate.
He starts by reviewing everything, and then he can give credit to what he thinks deserves credit. And the legislative history and the decision in Campbell upon which de novo is taken from show quite clearly what Congress had in mind. And it's a thorough review, which he doesn't have to give deference as compared to the subsection A, where he has to give clearly erroneous deference to the magistrate's findings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Aaron against the...